Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Buy one, get one free. That's pretty much how a bunch of proposed constitutional amendments have been packaged for Florida's voters this fall.
Putting 20 measures on the ballot is simply not going to make it.
Also this week, one standalone amendment to restore former felons' voting rights has become a cause celeb for Democrats.
The reason that it's going to be on the ballot, there's a reason that the CRC is addressing it, there's a reason that all these people want to change how it's done.
We'll also take a look at how the GOP candidates' campaigns for Florida governor are going, examine what's being done to prevent another Parkland school shooting, and check out some possible changes to the state's saltwater fishing rules. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Florida voters will pick a slate of new state leaders, local legislative representatives, city and county officials, local referendums, and toward the end, if they make it, a dozen or so requests to change the state constitution. Yet some of those requests are likely to give voters pause upon a close read. Do they want to ban indoor vaping while simultaneously banning offshore drilling? Lynn Hatter reports on why some of the amendments are bundled together with others.
The Florida Constitution Revision Commission is putting 8 amendments before voters to consider, but there's a catch. Most of those 8 are comprised of 2 or 3 different proposals.
And I'm guessing that because some of these are grouped together, that's going to endanger them a bit more than the ones that than if they had kept them separate. But I have to agree with them. I mean, putting 20 measures on the ballot is simply not going to make it.
There are more than 400 ideas for the CRC to consider, and ultimately they settled on about 20. To reduce the number further, some got grouped together. Florida State University political scientist Carol Weissert, who leads the Leroy Collins Policy Think Tank, says she understands why the CRC decided on bundling, but she adds some of those ideas grouped together are a stretch, like one that requires a supermajority trustee vote before public universities can raise fees. It's paired with greater benefits for first responders and military members, along with putting the state college system into Florida's constitution.
That's one where I think it's people might say, well, I certainly support survivor benefits, but what is this going to do to universities? Or are they just going to say, okay, survivor benefits, I'm for this.
You have the big another entity to decide what happens with charters tied with civic education. So one thing looks good and the other things don't look so good.
Joanne McCall heads the Florida Education Association, a teachers union, and she does not care for the CRC's bundling tactic.
And shame on the CRC for wasting all this taxpayer money to do absolutely nothing and make a sham of the system. And when we look at the people that sat on that commission that created some of these term limits for school board members and this charter operation, those same people that were bringing those proposals actually are tied to charter schools and actually are going to profit if that makes its way through the ballot.
There's also a political reality. Pairing potentially unpopular ideas with others can neuter opposition, as in the case of the university fee issue, which schools don't like, and the first responder benefits. But Weiser says what may be worse is the increasing likelihood that voters will just be confused.
Everything is political these days, but you do have that sort of the framing. And as you said, I think it's confusing for voters.
And a confused voter is a likely no voter. Depending on which side of the bundled amendments one falls on, that may or may not be a bad thing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
The fight to restore voting rights for those with a felony in their past has become a rapidly intensifying factor in shaping the upcoming state elections. Ryan Daly reports after an apparent political victory for Governor Rick Scott's cabinet, Democratic challengers are hitting back.
Governor Rick Scott and his cabinet member, Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam, are running for higher office in what promised to be contentious elections. There's an energized Democratic candidate for state attorney general and Sean Shaw vying for current AG Pam Bondi's seat. After a federal appellate court gave a favorable decision to the state's clemency board by granting a stay on a lower court's injunction, Democrats are centering their rally cry on a citizens' initiative amendment. Tallahassee mayor and Florida gubernatorial candidate Andrew Gillum has tried to capitalize on the clemency board's efforts to keep the current restoration system intact.
Florida is just one of three states that still have this kind of arcane Jim Crow system of rights restoration. One of three states.
Gillum filed a records request on Wednesday for all documents and communication explaining why the clemency board sought a stay on the injunction. During a speech from the Capitol steps this week, Gillum cast a wide net while trying to garner support for Amendment 4.
This is not a black issue. The right to vote is not a black issue. We know that African Americans and people of color are disproportionately impacted, but the majority of the 1.7 million people in this state who have had their rights taken away are white people.
Another Democrat in the gubernatorial race, Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine, says he doesn't think Governor Scott's actions will play well with the voters he's met around the state.
I gotta say, everywhere I go, from Pensacola to Key West, people believe in second chances. People believe that felons should have their rights restored if they pay their debt to society. It's incredible because, the one thing people don't like is they don't like meanness, they don't like cruelty, they don't like outright racism. And I think that this is a step backwards, kind of going back to the old Florida Jim Crow laws.
Democratic Representative Sean Shaw, who is campaigning for attorney general, questions why Governor Scott's cabinet isn't giving more consideration to a stance he thinks most Floridians take on the issue.
And it's a system that, quite frankly, the majority of Floridians do not agree with. It's the reason that it's going to be on the ballot. There's a reason that the CRC is addressing it. There's a reason that all these people want to change how it's done, because a lot of Floridians, the majority of Floridians, believe we ought to do it differently.
Desmond Meade has a very personal dog in this fight. After serving his time for a felony gun possession conviction, Meade experienced homelessness and other obstacles before getting his law degree and becoming a champion for the cause. As president of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, he called for a stay to be put on the injunction in the days before the appellate court's 11th-hour decision. He says he would rather not see the system get a facelift at the discretion of those who hold office.
One of the main elements of that was that the power to decide which American citizen get to vote and which American citizen don't get to vote, taking that out of the hands of politicians.
Meade says the effort to overhaul the current restoration system transcends politics.
So we wanted to really make sure that we gave American citizens an opportunity to earn the eligibility to vote again. And even though it says voting, it's beyond. It's beyond politics. It's beyond partisan lines. It's beyond race.
The battle for rights restoration is getting attention beyond Florida. Federal Judge Mark Walker's ruling in late March, declaring the state system unconstitutional, caught the eye of civil rights leader Reverend Al Sharpton, who fired up a crowd of hundreds at the Capitol in support of Amendment 4. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
Still to come on Capitol Report, there are two Republicans running for Florida governor and possibly a third. But is it too late to start a campaign just 4 months out from the primary election?
Given where we are in the election cycle, trying to put together a campaign and running and getting everything together in advance of the primary later this year seems to be a substantial task.
We have two stories about the ongoing fallout from mass school shootings and how Florida is trying to address them, first in the realm of physical school safety.
My goal is to get to the truth and create a best practices for all schools nationwide. We need minimum standards. There are none right now.
And we also have two literal fish stories this week. While wildlife officials insist they have no evidence, beachgoers worry people fishing for sharks on the shore increases the chance for attacks.
On Capitol Report from the Associated Press, Gary Finout brings us up to date on some things going on the gubernatorial picture. One thing we haven't addressed too much is what is going on as far as the Republican candidates for governor here in Florida, of which we have two declared and one possibly yet to declare. We have Ron DeSantis, Adam Putnam, and we may have Richard Corcoran. What's the latest with each of the three of those folks?
Well, as it regards to the Speaker of the House, all indications are is that he is still very seriously considering getting into the race, and that I continue to have people who tell me that they believe that he is very, very interested in doing it. I mean, the timing of it is very interesting because given where we are in the election cycle, trying to put together a campaign and running and getting everything together in advance of the primary later this year seems to be a substantial task. He has had some money in a political committee that he's been able to gather, although he did use a fair amount of it on some television ads that he did earlier in the year, if you recall those controversial ads involving sanctuary cities. But every indication is he is going to get in, which makes it very interesting. And the question is, well, how does that impact the race? I mean, as of right now, we anticipate that there are two major candidates on the Republican side at current, and that is Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam and U.S. Representative Ron DeSantis. And they are embarking so far on completely different strategies. Mr. DeSantis is basically, as of right now, he is spending a lot of time on Fox News, appearing on a lot of radio programs and television programs with Fox News. He's mostly talking about national issues. He's talking about the Russia investigation and the special prosecutor and making a lot of comments that have earned him praise from President Trump. Clearly, his strategy is he's getting a lot of earned media and he's, you know, getting his name out there through those appearances. Putnam, meanwhile, he is engaged in what we would think of a more traditional campaign here in Florida. He has put together a campaign team. He's doing a lot of grassroots efforts. He's making a lot of appearances all across the state. And along the way, he's also been able to put up a somewhat substantial amount of money for his campaign. Now, what's interesting is that he just recently started rolling out ads, television ads. And so on top of the fact that he's doing all this groundwork, he's now getting up on TV. And so he's kind of just doing step by step. I mean, we would anticipate that now that he is on television, that he will remain on television. Usually the sort of the school of thought is once you get up on television, you don't want to go dark between now and election time. And of course, got to remember, here in Florida, it's not just the date of the election, it's the period of early voting and things of that nature where you want to be able to have people knowing who you are and getting out there and voting even in advance of Election Day.
But we still have a ways to go, and we'll see what happens twixt now and the next couple of months. From the Associated Press, Gary Finout. Thanks, Gary.
No problem.
Between a Medal of Heroism ceremony honoring a school resource officer and a commission convened to investigate the failings that led up to a Valentine's Day massacre, mass school shootings still took center stage in Florida this week. Sasha Cordner reports.
I didn't know what happened. It was a sound that I never would imagine. The sound that I heard was not what I thought was a gunshot. It was like an explosion.
That's Marion County Sheriff's Deputy Jimmy Long. He's also the school resource officer who's credited with taking quick action that prevented a mass shooting at Forest High School in Ocala. Governor Rick Scott says Long's quick response, along with others, allowed him to take the 19-year-old gunman into custody.
On the morning of April 20th, 2018, Deputy Long heard the loud bang of gunfire from inside the school. My heart would be pounding. Without hesitating, he was trained and he knew exactly what to do. He immediately responded to the source of the sound. Within 3 minutes, he found and apprehended the suspect, saving countless students from potential harm. He put his own life at risk to keep his students safe. It's because of his bravery that the tragedy that could have been never had the chance to unfold.
One person was shot in that incident, but officials say it could have been much worse. Marion County Sheriff Billy Wood says this really was the work of different agencies working very well together during this active shooter incident.
We all need to remember it wasn't just solely law enforcement. You know, EMS, the teachers, the staff, the students themselves. Everybody came together, and as a community, that's how it works. It doesn't work by just one sole entity. It happens because we all come together, and that's what makes us great. That's what makes us great in Marion County.
But the same could not be said for the agencies that responded to Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in February, says Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gualtieri.
This was a situation where the Coral Springs Police Department and the Broward County Sheriff's Office were not on the same radio channel because you had different things happening, and they weren't talking. They couldn't talk. And that, in my view, from what I know at this point, absolutely affected the operation, affected the response.
He says it was the police radio and 911 systems that contributed to the chaos during and after the Parkland school shooting.
If you are on a cell phone and you're in Parkland and you call 911, it goes to the Coral Springs Fire 911 answering point. But if you're calling from a hard line, it goes to the Broward Sheriff's Office Communication Center. So you had a whole bunch of people calling in from the school, calling in from cellular, that was going to Coral Springs Fire. The law enforcement first responder is the Broward Sheriff's Office. So the Broward Sheriff's Office wasn't getting information in their communication center about a significant law enforcement event, and information was having to be transferred and passed.
Gualtieri chairs the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Commission, which recently had its first meeting. Under a new gun safety law signed last month, they created the commission tasked with investigating the Parkland shooting. There were also some other issues discussed during the meeting about the radios, and fixing something like that may require a legislative change, says Florida Department of Law Enforcement Commissioner Rick Swearingen.
This is frustrating to listen to. It's very similar to after 9/11, when we realized all of the silos that had to be broken down. A lot of that exists here, whether it's communicational or whether it's organization, whether it's jurisdictional, whatever. A lot of this is because of silos that exist between agencies and entities. As far as the SLRS, the state radio system, we pay vendors a lot of money for that system. And if we find out there are issues here with that system, we need to make sure that our legislature holds those vendors accountable and that we fix those issues with that radio system.
The fathers of three Parkland victims also sit on the panel. And Max Schachter says his goal is simple.
My goal is to get to the bottom of what happened in this crisis that ended in 17 lives being taken and 17 injured, including my little boy, Alex. Out of this commission, I hope that we develop a much better nationwide national school safety standards. We're going to investigate what works, what doesn't work, and out of this should come that, and a national school safety strategy should be implemented.
Looking into the infrastructure of classrooms, as well as looking into the agencies and people who had an interaction with the accused Parkland school shooter, are just some of the areas the commission will also cover. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
This week, Florida's 67 district school superintendents held a mental health summit to address what they'd already considered a crisis before the Parkland tragedy. Led by Broward Superintendent Robert Runcie, the summit drew lawmakers, behavioral health providers, and state agency heads to Orlando for what many called an unprecedented gathering. We get more on that story from Margie Menzel.
The superintendent's mental health summit had been in the works for months. It was actually the second one. The first had been in January, just weeks before Nicholas Cruz opened fire at Stoneman Douglas High. Ironically, it had been Broward's Runcie, president of the Florida Association of District School Superintendents, who led the group to address student mental health, which he considers a grave crisis. Runcie estimates 70% of Florida students have been traumatized by adverse childhood experiences, ranging from poverty to family violence to the death of a parent. And U.S. Census data show roughly 1 million of Florida's under 18 population experiencing behavioral health disorders that negatively affect their ability to function in school, at home, or in the community. Former Florida Secretary of State Kurt Browning is the superintendent of the Pasco County Schools.
These kids deserve a chance to work themselves with help, with supports, out of poverty and out of the trauma that they're experiencing. I don't care what your political persuasion is, whether you're a conservative, a liberal, Democrat, Republican, this is an issue that affects all of us. And if we don't seriously come to terms with it and think of ways, develop ways to support these kids and families, we are just getting further and further, deeper and deeper in this hole.
That seemed borne out by the number of state leaders who attended the summit, including Senate Appropriations Chairman Rob Bradley and Kathleen Passidomo, chairwoman of the Senate Subcommittee for K-12 Appropriations. And of course, since the shooting, the legislature passed the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Act. Among its many provisions, the measure includes nearly $70 million in mental health assistance to the schools, $6.7 million for youth mental health awareness and training, and $9.8 million to the Department of Children and Families for additional community action treatment teams, an alternative to out-of-home placement for minors with serious behavioral health conditions. Many superintendents, especially those from poor rural counties, asked what would happen when the initial funds ran dry. Collecting data on their outcomes was essential, they were told. Jason Broder chairs the House Healthcare Appropriations Subcommittee. He says the schools must make sure the information is captured to show its value.
In providing these for the schools, I think the value will become obvious, and we'll have to make it more of a priority. If we want to achieve the outcomes of students being able to make healthy choices that allow them to focus on their education.
And Senate Budget Chief Bradley says lawmakers will be monitoring the school's strategy and progress.
The thing that ignited it was the Stoneman Douglas incident and then the Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Act, because it challenged our local partners to find solutions, because they're the ones on the ground. And then we will come and get the feedback and fill in the blanks and provide the necessary support.
Few attendees doubted the summit was an historic moment, and certainly not Robert Runcie.
I think now is the time. This is, you know, our moment in history to get this right, and I believe it'll have a dramatic impact on the future of public education and the outcomes. Because ultimately what we want to do is to give our kids the skills to be able to deal with life challenges, to be able to learn from them, and to be successful citizens of the world.
Kurt Browning says part of the superintendent's job is to keep lawmakers engaged as they move forward. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Margie Menzel.
Florida's wildlife commissioners are looking into new rules aimed at protecting sharks, the people who fish for them, and the people who swim at the beach. Regan McCarthy has more.
Jessica Veach was enjoying a beautiful day last summer at Bathtub Reef Beach in Stuart when she heard her 3-year-old daughter Violet scream. Veach turned and immediately scooped up her daughter.
Out of the ocean at Bathtub Beach, with the flesh hanging off of her leg, and the blood-stained water that she was in with her own blood.
Veach's daughter had been bitten by a shark. She was airlifted to a hospital where she started down a long path to recovery. Veach says she believes the shark attacked because of the activity of nearby fishermen.
I didn't know how fishing at the beach that day would put my child in danger.
Veach says officials from the International Shark Attack File have classified the attack as provoked because of the activities of the fishermen there. Meanwhile, Melbourne Beach Mayor Jim Simmons says stories like Veach's make residents and tourists hesitant to enjoy the beach in his community. He says some onshore shark fishers don't act responsibly.
The problem is not education. The problem is with an irresponsible minority who refuse to respect the right of others to use our beaches safely. These irresponsible fishers insist correctly that they can legally shark fish and blood bait whenever and wherever they desire. It's not even a matter of who was there first. I personally witnessed shark fishers come and set their blood baits among already present swimmers and surfers many times.
While we are concerned with any victims who have had interactions with wildlife, there is no evidence to date that suggests that shore-based fishing activities draw sharks to nearshore waters and increase the occurrence of the nearby shark bites.
That's Jessica McCauley, director of the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission's Marine Fisheries Management. She says while media attention can sometimes make it seem like shark attacks are a frequent occurrence, they're actually rare. Still, Veach argues it doesn't make sense that the use of bait near the shore doesn't draw sharks to the area. She says it's common sense with almost any animal that feeding it can lead to negative consequences.
You wouldn't feed raccoons in your backyard because they would return to that spot looking for food. Why are we treating our shores any differently?
FWC Commissioner Joshua Kelman says as a soon-to-be dad, he's moved by Veach's story. And he says it's clear to him action is needed.
I think our staff and our law enforcement do a great job. I would be interested to know more detail about kind of those steps. But I am supportive of taking action quickly to implement some sort of accountability.
Commissioners have directed staff to begin a rulemaking process to address shore-based shark fishing. Officials say they'll work to include all stakeholders in the process. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally, this week, we have just one more fish story for you. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission wants more research for approving the harvest of previously endangered Goliath groupers. But as Andrew Quintana reports, many are against the decision because they say the science does not back up the reasoning.
Jessica McCauley is the Marine Fisheries Manager for the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission. She explains the current state of the once endangered Goliath grouper species.
So Goliath are recovering and becoming more abundant in parts of Florida, especially on artificial reefs. While they opportunistically take angler snappers and groupers, these species represent a small portion of their diet, with them primarily consuming baitfish and crustaceans. There are many unknowns in the life history and biology, especially maximum age, which makes it challenging to determine the status of the fishery.
The recent growth in Goliath grouper populations has made the FWC consider various ways of managing the species, which includes limited harvesting. But Tom Ingram, CEO of the Diving Equipment and Marketing Association, says the science behind Goliath groupers is not solid enough to support the need to harvest.
There's no scientifically valid stock assessment for Goliaths, which is needed prior to opening the species. So DEMA favors maintaining the current prohibition on harvest and possession of Goliath grouper in Florida. We believe that FWC or NOAA or another appropriate organization should undertake a more thorough stock assessment of the Goliath grouper to include research on age prior to opening up this fishery at all or even considering it.
Advocates for the Goliath grouper also worry Florida's tourism industry will take a hit. On Thursday, the FWC Commission said they'd focus on further research for now. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ange Quintana.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. We also thank Margie Menzel and Andrew Quintana. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.